Okay, I'm going to say again, this is Truth Quest with Melody, and this is KHEN 106.9 Salida. And I've got a great night lined up. Actually, we're going to do an extended program tonight. In the first 2 hours, I've got a special guest, Doug Millar, and I think he's got some very interesting information to add. But for those that want to listen to the program afterwards, they're archived at www.gimmesometruth.info. And we've also the views expressed on this program are those of myself and of my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And Doug, I'm going to let you tell the audience about yourself, and then, you know, maybe mention what we're doing tomorrow, and we'll go from there. How's that? Because I was trying to look at your bio, and you don't have a lot out there to try to, to find her.
I put out a lot of emails and things, but I've sold quite a few DVDs. Actually, most of them are VHS videos, you know, over the years.
Uh-huh.
But no, I've never had a website, so consequently, as an investigator, I've never really had much help to create one, and I've never charged my investigation in the last 20 years, doing this full-time in 21 states, so consequently, it's been kind of lean pickings, but my goal, of course, living right here in Santa Rosa, a little background, folks, maybe I'll just mention that first, how I got involved in investigating violent crimes against children covered up by a few crooked people in law enforcement. And I'm talking about the local level here in Santa Rosa, and the county level, the state level, as well as the FBI and the CIA's involvement in these sick crimes. And I don't expect you to believe what I'm saying, but I do expect you to be intellectually honest enough to check out the sources I give you, because in talking with Melody yesterday, I was referred to her by someone, Deborah Tavares, who lives here in the county, and we usually meet once a week and look at a video as well as discuss things and how a few of us can impact the local community and the state here on the political level. But anyway, she had a conflict tonight, and so she's been on, I guess, your show before. What, at least once or more than once, hasn't she, Melody?
Right. She's been on my other program on Oracle Broadcasting. That's on
Saturday
mornings.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yes.
So anyway, I moved here in 1982. I grew up in Alaska from 1945 until 1980, and so 35-year resident of Alaska. And when I moved here because of somebody in high school married a California girl and moved here. And since my wife and I visited here several times, we just fell in love with the place and figured if we ever left Alaska and retired someplace, this is the place we'd go to. Well, as it turned out, during the Women's Lib days, back in the late 1970s, she decided it would be more fun to be single, and
oh, no.
You know, we had three young children, and so since some of our girlfriends had done it, she decided to give it a try, too, and so our children suffered a really tragic thing, thinking that they had a happy family life, and then seeing all destroyed. But anyway, I ended up moving here, and then I was here from 82 until 92, actually in the Santa Rosa Chamber of Commerce on a weekly basis, meeting with the board of directors, because I was on the legislative committee and very active. We meet at 7 a.m. On a weekly basis, and I was active as an elected official in politics here, and also active in my church. And so I really enjoyed politics, and the reason I got involved, I guess, mainly is because we go way back in 1963, I was a fan of President John F. Kennedy, and he inspired me to start jogging as a young adult. And so I've I kept it up for decades, and but then when he was assassinated, I never trusted Vice President Lyndon Baines Johnson, and so I, even though all my friends were in the Democrat Party in Alaska, I decided to read Goldwater's book, Conscience of a Conservative, and I thought, well, man, this guy thinks just like I do. And so I chose to donate to the Democrat Party, and I see all my friends were there, but I decided to help organize Goldwater's campaign in Anchorage and work with the people that were, you know, had been involved at our headquarters, et cetera. And the result was that when George Wallace came along, and he was, you know, a Democrat from the South, from Alabama to be exact, the governor down there. And after he was ran one time and was very successful as the American Independent Party, after running as a Democrat, he did it again in 1972. You know, a lot of key people got involved in his campaign, and he had a good campaign going. One of my friends became his national public relations chairman, but then, of course, he was shot, and so that ended a chance to build a third-party movement to really get rid of the Council of Foreign Relations. But that was in 72, where back in 1966, a record came out, a record set, actually, with a long play record, so I hope everybody writes this down. It's called Illuminati. And it was put out by a Jew by the name of Myron Fagan, F-A-G-A-N. And he was a New York Hollywood playwright. And so he, on the cover of his long play records, as I recall, there were three of them, he has on the cover the headquarters of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York City. And, of course, it was run by David Rockefeller. And what was so fascinating about it is he said that the Council for Relations, when I say he, I'm talking about Fagan, the Council for Relations is a front or a division of the Illuminati. And since I knew that there was only one person, to my knowledge, that ever left the Council for Relations to expose it, and his name, of course, was Admiral Chester Ward, W-A-R-D, and so I decided that I better do my homework on the Council for Relations. But back,
yeah. But what is the background of Fagan? Do you want to give a little bit more? Because I get him. Is he the one that was related somewhat to the Procter and Gamble, or am I?
Oh boy, you know, it's been so long ago now. Melody, answer that. I couldn't even answer that question but you can go on the YouTube, and you can actually hear him giving his speech that was put on the LP records, and you can hear the whole thing talking about
the Council of Foreign Relations. It's worth hearing.
Excuse me?
I said it's worth hearing. So.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I mean, it's so shocking because see. When he put that information out in 1966, that was the same year that, a man by the name of, I've gone black now. Give me a curve here, ask me a question about it. But anyway, the called Tragedy and Hope.
Oh, okay. Right.
Praising the Council of Foreign Relations. So here are two people from opposite ends of the spectrum came out with books, information, claiming that it's such a wonderful organization, it's such an evil organization.
Carol Quigley is his name.
Carol Quigley, thank you, yes. And so then there were two excellent books put out right after Quigley put out his book in 1966. One, of course, the first one that came out was by Dr. Cleon Skousen, former FBI agent, a Canadian constitutional attorney.
Okay, he's the father of Joel Skousen, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Either father or uncle. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it could be uncle. Yeah, you might be right.
And but anyway, it was fascinating. So I read that, and that's when I first woke up to how evil the Council Formulations was, because I had bought a book written in 1962 or 63, and I bought it in 64 at a Gold War rally in Los Angeles where there were thousands and thousands of people there. It was amazing. A man by the name of, I'm getting into areas I didn't really plan on going to, but the bottom line is he wrote the book, Nender Call It.
Oh, okay, you're talking about Gary Allen.
Well, this is
John Stormer.
Yeah, exactly, John Stormer, exactly. And then he came up with a second book after that, after he became a Christian. He called A Nation of Sheep. And but Stormer is one of a kind. And Stormer, I was told that if you only buy one book while you're here, you should buy this book by former FBI agent Dan Smoot. And I said, okay, well, and it was called The Invisible Government. And, of course, it was all about the Council Formulations. I said, well, I just got here. I'm new to all this stuff. I'm going to look at all the tables and see what I don't have a lot of money I can't afford. And so I went ahead and looked at all the tables and went back and bought that one book. But I was so horrified by scanning it that I put it under my bed and didn't even want to read it because I thought, how could people be born in America, raised in America, become millionaires and very wealthy in America, and then turn against our country and want to destroy our Constitution and have a one-world secret invisible government and a dictatorship. And so I didn't want to believe it until Skousen's book came along. And when he was quoting all these statements by Quigley in his book, that and all these other people boasting about what they were doing, it was irrefutable. So I could have learned 8 years earlier, but I was just too horrified to want to believe it, you know. But, of course, I didn't quit investigating the Council Formulations and the evils that befall us, obviously, because I learned that the John Birch Society claimed that there was, yes, there was Illuminati, that it was operating back in the 1700s, but there was no evidence it was operating today.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and so I, being naive, I actually joined the John Birch Society in 66, and I was in there for a total of 16 years. And but see, turned out there was controlled opposition.
Yeah, you came right into
this. Robert Welch was a secret Masonic member. And so the result was that I've got a man I just had on my calling me. I can't take the call, obviously, but sorry, getting distracted here. But the bottom line is that, you know, there's people in the John Birch Society are wonderful, patriotic people, but they don't understand that they're in a controlled organization.
What you're talking about is prevalent in just about every aspect of, you know, going on around in our world right now. I mean, that's why, I mean, once you start learning how they work and you understand the control freaks that are at the helm, they got to control everything. And so if they control the opposition, then, you know, they control both sides. So
exactly.
Even in our warfare, the warfare is done the same way. So
of course. So if they can, if they do like they did Council of Formulation, John Birch Society, and tell you 99% truth, but they don't tell you about the Council, the Illuminati being alive and well today, then they naturally you believe everything else they're telling you, so you're going to believe that part too.
Right.
And at least most people are, unless they're willing to look into other things that are not printed by the Birch Society. But, you know, I I take my hat off to Robert Welch for waking up millions of people. But when he put out that book, Thunder Call It Conspiracy, it was Gary Allen. And, of course, Larry Abraham told me we were friends. He signed us up to the Birch Society up in Alaska after I studied for a year, because I knew I would not be a passive member. I was a State Farm agent, the second one in Alaska, and I knew that if I got involved, I would be a very active one. And so I want to make sure my wife was going to go along with the idea, because I didn't want to get too far out ahead of her. I knew I was going to scare her to death when she had learned how evil things were. And so the result was we both joined the same night. But eventually she just told our children she could not handle it, and she decided to divorce me because she couldn't handle the truth. But she said, I'm sad to say that your dad is right about everything he warned me about and told me about. It's all coming to truth. Well, you know, but anyway, it still traumatized our children. But bottom line is that freedom's not free, and if we're not willing to fight and expose the enemies that control our country and the world, I tell people that we deserve what's going to happen to us, but our children, our grandchildren, don't deserve what we know is happening, so we better quit just watching the TV and having a beer or whatever and get out there and help turn our country around.
Well, Doug, don't you find that, I mean, I know in my own right, I'm just about a good portion of my spare time is trying to just keep up learning and following all the many areas that those who have trying to control what is happening and what's going to happen, because these guys have sat down and planned these things, you know, not just decades in advance, you're probably centuries in advance of where they want to go and what they want to do. And so when you start even just getting into what's going on around us and how the logistics are going there, and then you start getting into the technological aspects and the genetic aspects and whatever, it just overwhelms you.
Sure does.
But it's out there and it's all around us. They're telling us everything they want to do. Even if they funnel it to us through science fiction or fantasy or whatever they want to do through the media, education system, however means they come up with it, even if they put it in our statues and our buildings and whatever, it's there in plain sight. It's just it's there all around us, and it's just a matter of us opening our eyes and realizing, you know, what's going on. So with you, you're saying that you started a whole lot earlier than I did on understanding what was going, you know, learning about what's going on. And so what got you into the heavy investigating and that sort?
Well, when I moved here to Santa Rosa in 82, I was active for 10 years in different organizations, and I helped organize a presidential campaign and different things for the county. And as it turned out, give you an example, and in 92, I was asked to be the county coordinator for Pat Buchanan's campaign for president. And so I issued a news release, but the Press Democrat, the only daily paper here in the county, is owned by the New York Times, and so naturally they weren't willing to give us any publicity that we even existed, as I expected, but I gave them the benefit of the doubt and give it a best shot. So then when Pat Buchanan defeated Bush, who President Bush was up for re-election, but Buchanan defeated him in New Hampshire, the first real primary, that shook up everybody so much that that night I issued another press release and gave it to the Press Democrat that we're having a meeting of the Pat Buchanan organization, and I thought maybe at least give us an inch or two of a mention that we were existing. No way. But then when Ross Perot came along.
Now you said 82. Did you say 82? But you're talking 92, aren't you?
92. No, I'm talking about 92 when I was talking about
Buchanan and Perot.
I said 82. I apologize. I didn't think it is. But anyway, yeah, it was 82 when I moved here. See, I've been here 10 years when I learned about what was going on here with the regarding violent crimes against children through law enforcement. And so, anyways, it turned out, I give you this background, because when we organized Ross Perot's campaign here, after the night he was announced on Larry King Live, I never trusted Larry King because of the fact that King had made fun of when people exposed the Trotteller Commission. And a book came out exposing it by Anthony Sutton, as I recall. And so, anyway, I was running a meeting, and we were trying to build a coalition of the left and right to lay aside our differences on race, religion, and politics in our county, and build a movement to protect our Constitution and our way of life so we could preserve our right to debate our differences later. Because we knew that by dividing us, they were basically conquering our country and destroying our Constitution. And so a buddy of mine happened to catch Larry King live and on TV that night and came rushing over to the meeting and said, "Hey, listen to this. Ross Perot said if he got an organization in all 50 states, he'd be willing to run for president on a third party." And I thought, wow, this is something I could probably get behind because he was such a successful businessman, and he was a billionaire and from Texas and Navy officer and all this and that. But since I was a co-founder of a high-tech company, I had his secretary's name and phone number, so I called the next morning and said I'd like to see what we could do to help put together an organization for his community in California, and he said, she said, "Well, he's surprised. All of us in the office here, we didn't even know he was going to do this. And so he's taking the next 3 days off, and he's huddling with some people offshore, and none of us can reach him for the next 3 days." And so anyway, what was so bizarre was that when we, three of us, decided to organize here in Sonoma County, and we were going to do it for the help the whole Bay Area get organized, and we went to a meeting of it with the people in the Bay Area that were organizing, and there were, I guess, well, first of all, there were hundreds of people there that first Saturday, and out of that, there were maybe two a dozen or so of us that were in this private meeting where we got acquainted as people in the different counties that wanted to build the organization in our counties, and bingo, the First Democrat heard that we were organizing. And so I told my friend, I said, "Now, since I'm organizing Pat Buchanan's campaign, he's going to lose in Super Tuesday here real soon," which, of course, took place today in the South.
Mm-hmm.
About 10 states, I think, participating. I said, "Let's wait till after Super Tuesday. And then we'll know whether Pat Buchanan will make it. He probably won't. Then we can. So you guys, go ahead and issue a press release anything you want to, but keep my name out of it. I enlist the phone number," and they assured me they would keep my name out of it. But when the Press Democrat reporter called my friend Don Mallory, he wanted to obviously know who was organizing the county, and Mallory broke my his commitment to me and gave this reporter my name and phone number. And so I get this reporter's call on my unlisted phone number. And so I asked him, "How did he know I was involved?" And he told me. So I couldn't deny it. So I went ahead and it was on part of the interview. And so the three of us, our interview was the headline story in the Sunday paper, the Press Democrat. And I thought, isn't this something? Now, obviously, the New York Times is back in Ross Perot, and they're not back in Pat Buchanan, but I never thought we'd get that kind of publicity. So I realized that he was obviously the fair-haired boy for the counsel foreign relations, you know, as a third-party candidate. So anyway, that's how I got involved.
So, let me make sure I'm following you here. Is it Buchanan or Perot you're saying was the CFR person?
I'm saying that because Perot was, first of all, Buchanan was running against somebody, George Bush, who had been on the board of directors of the Council of Foreign Relations.
Right.
And he defeated Bush in the primary in New Hampshire when Bush is up for re-election after 4 years as president.
Uh-huh.
Bush was in real trouble. And so what I'm saying is that when we couldn't get any stories out about Buchanan, but the Press Democrat, owned by the New York Times, was promoting Ross Perot's campaign, I realized that Ross Perot was being supported by the Council of Foreign Relations.
Okay, all right. That's what I was trying to get straight there because...
And that just shocked me to see that kind of publicity, you know, when I realized that I was on the wrong horse again.
Okay, so now you...
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Okay, so now move forward to your investigation.
Hello?
Are you there? Did we lose you? Hello? Hello?
Hello?
You can't hear me?
No, I couldn't hear you all of a sudden.
Okay. Well, don't be surprised.
I just asked, did that make sense? And all of a sudden you went dead.
Well, don't be surprised. I mean, it may be that if we don't make it through the night, we may have to do this on, do a pre-record and do this another way. Sometimes... things when you want to get them out, kind of things go dead, and I'm sure you've experienced that.
Oh, definitely, I'm sure I have. As a guest on a few shows from time to time, but usually they leave us alone. But we're covering a lot of heavy things tonight, so if we have more trouble later, I wouldn't be surprised. But hopefully, we'll get through it here.
Yeah, because we haven't gotten into anything yet.
Not much, not really.
So with your investigation, you know, you were very politically active, in other words, and
right. Then,
and you started distrusting the system because you were realizing that, you know, the political system was controlled on both sides of the aisle, and again, you have your controlled opposition there, and so how did it get to where you started being more involved in the investigation aspect?
Well, in that same year, in 92, because of that headline story in the Press Democrat, a lady called who, Don Mallory's phone number was listed in the phone book, and so she called him and talked to him, and so then Don called me, since I was unlisted, and said, hey, Doc, you and I are both running for the Republican Central Committee, and I just got a phone call from a lady who wants to meet with us because of our story. And I said, Don, you're the ones always telling me I'm overcommitted. Now I'm telling you, as you know, I'm helping organize two high-tech companies right now this year. Plus, I've been in the third one, the first one, of course, for like about 6 years. Now I'm telling you, I'm overcommitted, and I can't even think about it until after this election, because we're being challenged, both of us, heavily, and so if we don't get out there and hustle, we're not going to get elected. I've been out for 2 years because I was organizing another high-tech company, but anyway, the bottom line was that I said, so Don, how about this? Let me ask you some questions. And he said, I don't want to tell you anything about on the phone. I said, well, Don, come on. We've been friends for years. I mean, are you talking about something that involves politics? He said, yes. I said, which party? He said, both. I said, really? And so, are you talking about something local, state, or national? All three. So, I finally deduced the fact that he was on something pretty hot. I said, okay, well, call him back in 30 days, and after we make sure we get elected to the Central Committee, which we both were successful in doing, then we'll talk. Well, three times within a week, he called me, the third time of all things, Melody. It happened to be on the date that Jeff, anyway, I don't want to get all detailed. The bottom line is that I had nothing on my calendar that day.
Mm-hmm.
And I woke up and I forgot to even put in on there about there was going to be a prayer group meeting. And this quarterback from Washington State was going to be a speaker giving his Christian testimony. And so I forgot to even put that on my calendar, even though some of my friends were the ones who were organized in the county. And so I thought, how could I be? That's on my calendar. You just booked up, a day or two or a week in advance. And so I felt, and I've never experienced this before in my life, I felt like when I looked at the calendar, nothing was there. I marked down about the prayer meeting I forgot to put on the calendar. And so I thought, well, why do I feel this way? I think I should take the day off after I go to the prayer meeting. And the idea is we invite business and political and government officials to the hear the testimony of a person who buy the lunch, and they hear a personal Christian testimony.
Okay, but let me go ahead and state that I've got Doug Millar as my guest this evening, and we're talking about his life and experiences, and so and this will be again posted at www.givemesometruth.info if you miss any part of this interview or would like to hear it again. So Doug?
Okay, thank you, Melody. This word gets really wild. So I felt inspired for the first time in my life. I've been a Christian since 1964, and now we're talking about 92, 28 years later. I felt inspired to do something I'd never even thought about doing before, and that was to take the day off during a busy work week and just take my Bible, and after I went to this kind of a brunch, spend the rest of the day and just go in the woods and relax and read the Bible and pray and ask the Lord, what do you want me to do with the rest of my life, Lord? Because I know the new world order. I've been studying the Illuminati for all these years, and I know they've basically conquered our country, but they haven't got our guns yet. So what should I do? And I get out of the shower, and I made the commitment to do that. And I got out of the shower, and there's a phone call from my buddy Mallory again for the third time. I said, how could this be, Lord? I thought, we had a deal. You want me to spend some time with you. And so I thought, I can't call Don back and tell him. First of all, I can't really ignore him. There's nothing on my calendar, and I can't tell him I'm too busy today. So I'll just call him back and tell him I'll spend enough. And so I call him and say, okay, Don, after I go to this prayer meeting, I'll spend 1 hour with you and this person you won't even tell me was male or female with one understanding. And I've never even suggested spending 1 minute with somebody, a stranger, to pray about a problem before. And here I am suggesting that we spend an hour, the second hour, praying about the problem and discussing solutions and everything. And he said, Doug, an hour? We need 3 or 4 hours just to talk about the problem. I said, Don, anybody can describe a problem in an hour. I'm not willing to change what I just made a commitment to the Lord about. But I tell you this, that now I'm not even willing to do this unless that second hour is committed that he or she will spend an hour with us in prayer, because we know this is a spiritual battle. And so he said, okay, let me call and see what I can put together. So he called back and said, okay, now I knew it's a lady. She has 2 daughters, and so she'd like to meet with us in a park. So that in case you want to, if you hear about the problem in an hour and she'll spend the second hour with us, if you want to spend more time with her to learn about the problem, at least her daughters, young daughters, ages 5 and 9, will have some place to play. I saw it fair, So we decided to meet before the luncheon. And 14 hours later, Melody, I never went to that luncheon. 14 hours later, I was driving home at midnight, realizing, my God, I just been shown the Achilles heel of the New World Order, violent crimes against children, that the FBI knows about right here in our county, and they're being covered up by the FBI and local law enforcement. I was just horrified. because it involves Satanism.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, with Bohemian Grove here and everything, it made sense that this could be one of the most evil counties, because it's also one of the most beautiful counties I've ever seen in the nation. So naturally, the money, people with money would be attracted here, you know? So that's how I got started.
Okay. All right.
Pretty wild.
Yeah, and I don't know which direction to go, but I do. I was listening to your interview that you did with Clay Douglas. I interviewed him a few months back. And,
oh, okay.
And it had to do with Columbine.
Yes.
So how did you get involved with the Columbine investigation?
Good question. Well, after, just to kind of lead into it, because we're talking about from 92 now, Columbine happened in 99.
Right.
7 years later, so let me kind of lead into it a little bit here by saying that after Polly Klass was kidnapped from our county, tortured and murdered here in our county.
Oh, that's right.
Back in, that was in October, she was kidnapped October 1st of 1993, and we'd had John DeCamp, and you said you've had him on your show.
I've had John DeCamp, Ted Gunderson.
From the FBI from Los Angeles.
Jim Rothstein.
And so I've been working with those people now. Started working with them in August of 1992 because DeCamp's book came out, of course, on April Fool's Day of that year. And so when we got it, 6 weeks after we got his book, DeCamp's book, the final cover, Child Abuse, Satanism, and Murder in Nebraska, we turned around and had John DeCamp in Santa Rosa speaking here.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked the date of 9/11, only because it was my sister's birthday, and it was in 92, and it was on a Friday night. So that seemed like a good night to, you know, get a good crowd out to hear him speak. And so, of course, we read about Ted Gunderson in there, and it's in the foreword of the book. And so we invited Ted out, and he came out here on November the 13th, Friday the 13th. We started using occult dates as much as possible to expose the fact that we knew sort of the numerology. And so anyway, that's how I got started. And so then after Polly was kidnapped and murdered, and of course everybody got so paranoid here that no one wanted to come to our meetings, and they were all fearful. The first day that Polly was kidnapped, because we had to camp and Gunderson speak, and three other people who were exposed in the CIA mind control and the Illuminati, speak in Santa Rosa and also in Polly Klass's hometown, both cities. Here are five nationally prominent people in a period of just, like a period of a year. We, everybody got paranoid and thought, oh, wow. One of my children, my grandchildren, would be next. And so the paranoia set in, and it destroyed our network of bringing the left and the right together mm-hmm. to build a real movement here. And so I went to Alaska for my fourth high school reunion and spent 8 months up there investigating, exposing things. Came back here in 95, and that's when I decided, okay, it's time to go on the road. You know, there's not much more I can do here. The paranoia is just too thick here. And so I ended up in calling Ted Gunderson, since he was filed as a Democrat to run against President Clinton. And so I arrived in Las Vegas in January the 1st of 1996. Only going to spend a week there and then head on down to Arizona, where I had my old RV. I was only getting 5 miles a gallon, so we had a family reunion in Alaska, so I stopped there to help Ted, and he liked what I was doing, so he said, Doug, I'll feed you as long as you want. I'll sleep on my couch here, and please stick around. He was the only person that had any political experience my whole campaign. I said, what? I said, well, I'll tell you what, Ted, you're getting the interviews and the word out nationally because of your running for president. I can't get that kind of publicity, so if you're willing to help me by feeding me, I'll be happy to stay here and help you, you know? So we did that for about 10, 11 weeks, something like that. And, of course, you ran out of money, and So to make a long story short, that was in 96. And then, of course, Ted and I were having a conference April 15th through the 19th weekend when and we had speakers every night. And all day Saturday and Sunday, had a big crowd there in an old casino, packed the place. And the result was, of course, then April 20th of 99 is when the Columbine High School massacre took place. Well, I was planning on going to the National Rifle Association's National Convention. As you know, it was held in May 1st weekend there in Denver, scheduled before the massacre took place. Been scheduled, of course, probably for at least a couple of years before that. And so I was going to go there and just spend about a week or two there because I had drafted a man for Congress in Alaska who we got him elected to Congress, Howard Pollack. And he was had lost his right arm in World War II as a Navy officer. He was throwing a grenade and it went off prematurely and blew his arm off. And punctured his lungs so badly that he was in intensive care in America. He was there for 6 months and he was treated in the hospital for 2 years. So he was a walking miracle. And so he moved to Alaska as a business attorney after he got out of the military and got through law school. And so he, after 4 years in Congress, he decided he wanted to come back around for governor. I begged him not to do it. Long story short, he did it anyway because we already had a Republican governor. And I said, you're going to destroy the Republican Party and you're going to elect a Democrat for governor. You're going to elect a Democrat to your seat, a safe seat in the U.S. House. So set back the Republican Party for decades. He did it and lost in the primary and, of course, it destroyed the Republican Party. So he ended up becoming the national president of the National Rifle Association. He went to the chairs of the national board, and it was unanimously elected twice. And so I was going back there to be with him and tell him about what I learned about CIA mind control, because I'd already been in D.C. and etched him a lot in 93 and stayed at his home in 93 and living in Maryland close to the Pentagon. And the result was he ended up becoming national president of 8 organizations, and most of them he was elected president more than once. But anyway, that was a real mind blower in 99 when Columbine took place. And so I told people, I said, well, I'm going to call and see if I can stay up a little longer there in Denver and see if I can. So I called a friend there I'd met through being at Preparedness Expo there in Denver in 98, I think it was November, as I recall, around Thanksgiving. And so he said, yeah, you can sleep on my couch as long as you want to. So I had a place to stay, and so I decided, okay, I'm going to get a one-way ticket. He said two-way, because I believe that Columbine involves CIA mind control, how they create Manchurian candidates, mind control people who go out and commit these crimes, and usually end up killing themselves to destroy the evidence. And sometimes they don't get a chance to kill themselves, but that's part of their programming. And you can usually tell if a person is a mind control slave if they do it, because they usually end up killing themselves or being shot and murdered, killed before they get a chance to kill themselves. So anyway, and see, as I mentioned to you, before we started the show here, that I was buying 5 newspapers a day because I was following the Columbine massacre. And the first day, of course, there was nothing in the papers because it happened that morning. Next morning, I bought both Las Vegas papers, and I also bought the New York Times, USA Today, and the Wall Street Journal because I wanted to get a good cross-section overview of what was going on there. Because many of us who had read the family cover-up suspected there was involved mind control. And so it was at that time, it was the biggest school shooting in the nation's history, right?
Right.
So anyway, and only one of the papers, and I wish I'd kept the article and still have it to this day, but I somehow disappeared from my records. The bottom line is that students told police, and it was reported in the paper, that when the two shooters, before they came on the campus and before they pulled their guns, on Hitler's birthday, April the 20th, they had met with an older man in front of the school. And then they drove on the campus. And that was what I suspected. You know, there was a mind control, what's called a handler, who'd met with him before they went on the campus to make sure they locked in the program until...
Okay, you're talking about that met with Klebold.
And then, of course, so that's why I decided to move there.
Okay, but you're saying...
So do you have any questions about how... What I've covered so far?
No, but do you... Well, yeah, I mean, so Klebold met with this guy. Is that what
Hello?
You're saying? Here we go.
Yeah.
So Klebold and had met with this guy in front of the school is what you're saying.
Yes, they're both killers.
Okay.
Met with it, and they nicknamed this man Vodka. And I guess he asked that he be called Vodka. And... come to find out, the remember there was three boys in camouflage pants that had graduated from high school, and they were friends of Klebold and Dylan, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, and they were held at gunpoint by police in the field right next to the campus, and the helicopters picked them up for several hours. They were held at gunpoint there. And those boys later told police and gave this report that the year before they had been meeting with a man would go out and buy these boys, high school students, vodka, and he was teaching them how to build pipe bombs. And, but, of course, we didn't know what his real name was. And so I had a ally that came to our... I had weekly meetings there for 3 years whenever I was in town, which is about half the time I was on the road, half the time I was in Denver, and always I had weekly meetings because I was educating people, but I was also learning a lot of information from people because everybody knows pieces of puzzle. Nobody has the whole puzzle, right?
Right.
And so the result was that this one man came forward. He'd been trained with about 2,000 hours by the FBI. He said, I qualify as far as my training goes to be an FBI agent. And they trained me how to be an artist. Well, he wasn't a very good artist, but he could do a lot better than I could do. And so he learned from people who had seen vodka what vodka looked like. And so he drew a sketch and his size and everything. And so I put out a wanted poster, wanted dead or alive, and a sketch of vodka. And described him and what he did to train these children, to high school kids, to be killers, you know? And so it was pretty bizarre, and it was a crazy 3 years experience, I'll tell you that. But we learned a lot of things. We had Johnny Camp come in and speak several times there in the county, and which, as you know, was... It was just out of Denver.
Uh-huh.
And I just have a... Okay, I'm just getting distracted because my computer just went down. Okay, so do you have any questions? I mean, I could go on all day about this, but I don't know how much detail you want to get into.
This is a strong interest in this, and interesting enough that... Why did John DeCamp get involved in this?
Well, because I called him and told him, I said, John, you know, I suspected, that's why I moved here, and everything has fallen into place. We've learned that there's no question about it, that the FBI, why would the FBI become in charge of a school shooting? They had no jurisdiction, but they were in charge of the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the sheriff is the one that's in charge of law enforcement, crimes, and whatever, and so, but from the very get-go, first day, the FBI took over the investigation and the whole thing, and since Camp Lloyd wrote his book, of course, in 1992, and we knew the CIA was heavily involved in and CIA mind control created Manchurian candidates, and the FBI was protecting the CIA's exposés of these things.
Why do you think they picked that school?
Well, of all things, I'm glad you asked that, because in Jefferson County, come to find out, we learned from other people after we got there, that Jefferson County was getting funding from the federal government. It was kind of an experiment nationwide to introduce different issues and training for students to see how they reacted. For example, that was the first place, or one of the first places in America, where they introduced the so-called death education to see how the children, what the teenagers would handle. Well, first of all, we know that having been in school ourselves, that's a very insecure time for young people. And so here they would have these children, take them to, first of all, they'd write out a suicide note. Now, why would they have anybody write out a suicide note as a child? But they did. And they also would take them to a funeral parlor. They would ask them to touch the body and, just go through things that most parents wouldn't want to have to go through. Well, what parent would want to write a suicide note unless they were intending on committing it, you know? But these children were required to do that as part of their so-called death education. And so that's one of the reasons that, and there was other different projects also that were experimented. And so that specific school, Columbine, was an experimental school by the federal government.
Now, okay, I'm curious. I mean, its location being, you know, again, there, what might have been in that vicinity that would have made them a prime area to set up this kind of program, like some kind of corporation or school or you name it, you would think that they would be chosen because of, you know, of a proximity aspect. And I mean, just to, you know, be picked out of the blue. I mean, I know in that same area you had anywhere from, there was a number of major military defense companies at that point.
Sure. Yeah. You know, as you know, in Colorado Springs, you've got the Air Force Academy. And, we got the mountain range there with, I'm sure of Silicon Mountain, where they hollowed out the inside of that mountain there in Colorado Springs for the Air Force's. And then they found out that with X-ray, by flying over with X-ray machines, you could see right through the wall of the mountain. So they had to put in plating inside the mountain to protect what they were doing inside there and keep it secret. And so they say that there's underground railroad and highway between Washington, D.C. and the Rocky Mountains. So in case D.C. was ever attacked like it was back in 1812, when the Redcoats attacked Washington, D.C., and they had to have another place, so they put underground facilities in the mountains there, and in underground bases along the, what they call the Front Range.
Right. Now, as far as, am I correct in thinking that I remember hearing something to the effect that some of those kids had, it was maybe because of their parents' background?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Eric Harris's father was a pilot testing the new secret planes that our government had. And so let's go back a little bit. Let's see. Gary Powers. Do you remember when under Eisenhower the U-2 was shot down?
Right.
And what date was it? It was May Day, the founding date of the Illuminati.
Oh, really?
Yep. And Eisenhower was flying into Anchorage, and so there was going to be a parade, and we were going to get a chance to see President Eisenhower in Anchorage on his way over to meet with the Russian leader at the time. And now I don't even recall who it was, but that doesn't make any difference. The fact is that because the U-2 was shot down, it was such an embarrassment to the Russians that shot down a spy plane over Russia that Eisenhower, when he got to Anchorage, we were standing out there waiting for the parade to come by, the president to come by, I should say, and he didn't show up. And then we finally found out that the news announced that because the U-2 was shot down, the president was canceling his trip and was going to fly back to Washington, D.C. And so Gary Powers, now let me back up a little bit. I know somebody who actually was in a daycare as a child that was operated by Gary Powers' mother.
Okay.
And she turned out to be a CIA mind control victim. And she was living in Connecticut. I met her in 1993 in Washington, D.C., the national conference, just 2 weeks before Polly Klass was kidnapped in our county here. And so she said that as a child, of course, she didn't remember this until, you know, in her 30s or so, when most people don't remember what happened to them as children when they used to get sexually abused, tortured, and mind controlled, and sodomized and everything. But she said that she could remember when at the daycare they were sexually abusing the children. There was Gary Powers' mother was sexually abusing children there and had a staff that were doing it for the government. And one time she said that here I was sexually abused in a basement of a Catholic church nearby, and there I was nude. Came to, and I was walking around the halls of the church, and some priest found me and, of course, covered me up. And so I didn't have any of these memories until I was in my 30s, and I thought I was going nuts when I started having flashbacks of what I'd been through. I said, well, this makes sense then, because I know that Gary Powers was supposed to have committed suicide. He had cyanide pill in his ring, as I recall, and if he ever got captured, he was to take the cyanide pill. But he broke his programming and he refused to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it made sense about why Gary Powers didn't commit suicide, you know, because he'd broken program. He was another one of these mind control people.
Okay.
And our government's been using these mind control people for decades, these Manchurian candidates.
Okay, let me go ahead and say this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, and this is Truth Quest with Melody. And the views expressed on this program are those of myself and of my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHAN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And my guest today is Doug Millar, and at this point in time, he is talking about his experiences in investigating the Columbine massacre, whatever you want to call it. So,
do you have any questions for me, or
just keep going? Because I did ask, and I'm not sure if I got my answer there. On you were saying something to the effect of about the dad being a pilot.
Eric Harris's father was a test pilot, and so the point is, in my suspicion, of course, we'll never be able to prove it, but I believe that probably Eric Harris's father is also a CIA mind control victim, because you have to these people learn about new technology, weapons, as well as planes that are not reported to the public for sometimes a decade or more in advance, and so they trust people that have things compartmentalized in our minds. And
right.
So I urge everybody to look at both movies, The Manchurian Candidate, the one that Sinatra put out 13 months before Kennedy was assassinated, and it never came out as a video for a quarter of a century afterward. They refused to release it as a video, you know.
Right.
And everybody wanted to see it again after Kennedy was assassinated. Well, so So the point is, giving the Gary Powers example to help people understand what happened with Eric Karras' father, we suspect.
What I think I've run across, because in some of the other interviews, what I've done with these other Ted and Jim and John, is the fact that, you know, and then in reading some of the material of Kathy O'Brien, that you find that they kind of keep it in the family.
Of course they do.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. And so if one person in the family has been under that sort of thing, they kind of carry it down, keep the secret. So
generational.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So,
yep. In fact, I'm glad you brought up Kathy O'Brien, because the first time Kathy O'Brien and Mark Phillips ever spoke at a public event in America was where? In Polly Klass's hometown. February 3rd, 1993, 8 months before she was kidnapped from her own bedroom slumber party.
Hmm.
And who was her MC? Me.
Oh, pretty really?
Bizarre. Exactly. I tried to get my mentor, who knew a lot more about Satanism and mind control than I did, to do it, because I was still learning. I'd only been, she'd been mentoring me since, you know, we got acquainted back in let's see, about roughly the 1st of May of 92. So I was, you know, only 9 months into it. So I tried to get her to be the MC. She said, no, I want you to be. And so that's how I ended up being their MC. And see, have you ever suspected that maybe Kathy O'Brien and or Mark, possibly even both of them, are CIA mind control victims?
Yeah.
Good. Because I was able to verify that a roundabout way. Because
so,
I thought. Well,
so are you. Okay, let me back this up just a little bit. So, you know, that she's written a book and done all that, you know, and has this story and whatever.
It's an important book.
Yeah, it is. But because she brings up all these different people, but I guess if she's. Are you stating that then what a lot of the information that you give is true, or is there problems with it? What is it when you make that statement because of the
Well, okay. That's a good question. And what's happened was the reason they ended up coming here first to give a first public speech was because of the fact that Gunnarsson and the camp had been here, and we were exposing the CIA mind control, and so consequently, as it turned out, between Christmas and New Year's of 92, we've been doing it, as I say, for a lot, most of the 92, Mark and Kathy end up in Lincoln, Nebraska, meeting with DeCamp and Gunnarsson. And Gunnarsson spent 2 days debriefing them. And then their story was referred to us because we were exposing Aquino. And because
you can even fill us in on Aquino, too?
Oh, yeah, see, that's
oh, boy.
He was born right here in the San Francisco North Bay.
Oh, man, they're just, go ahead.
See, so you can see where, Gunnarsson, in fact, even Dr. Lynn Horowitz stated at the Conspiracy Con, it's an annual event, you know, each year there in Santa Clara County, which is just south of San Francisco, in the Silicon Valley area. And even when here just last June, Horowitz, who Gunnarsson and I had trusted in for years, and found out he was actually on the other side and, you know, had taken a knighthood, which, of course, the U.S. Constitution says if you take a knighthood, it's against the law of the Constitution. And so, anyway,
we get a few of those in this country, though, don't we?
Oh, of course we do. Like the Bushes, and a lot of people. But the point is that it's not something that you'd want to have under your belt if you weren't on the other side, because it's a violation of the Constitution. So, anyway, So I challenged my friend Horowitz to publicly disavow his knighthood, and so we could trust him more at the Conspiracy Con 2 years ago. And then last year, and of course that was a real big brouhaha. You can look on the internet and see where I'm challenging him and everything. Just Google my name and his under YouTube, and you'll see the confrontation we had. And then last year he came back and he wanted to, he decided he wasn't even going to have a booth there that last year, but he wanted to speak. And so that was fine. And I was very frustrated because he'd already, his lover, who'd caused his wife's divorce, him, when they had two children at home, she put out an email that actually, obviously he, I think it's safe to say he helped her write it, because he then after she wrote it under her name, then he sent it out to everybody on the internet that where he had emails of, and saying that there, he named about roughly a dozen of us, as I recall. I'd have to look at the list again, but he named 10 of us as, and she did, really, I should say, she named about a dozen of us, saying that we had to be Satanists because we always talked about Satanism. Well, I mean, that's like for us, being a Jew, I've got some Jewish blood, my wife was a German Ashkenazi Jew, like, if we go out and expose Nazis, are we therefore Nazis because we're exposing Nazis? I mean, the same mentality, the same logic. Wouldn't you say that's a reasonable?
Okay, so when you're talking about this and he's doing that, and then when I was looking up your name somewhere, then you guys got pulled into this thing with Barbara Hartwell. Is that right?
Oh, well, that, she came after Gunnarsson and me years ago.
Oh, okay.
And because of after we exposed so much at, I should say, in my case, Gunnarsson exposed other things, but I exposed so much at the Columbine High School massacre that eventually she was sent in after I left. I had no idea she was coming in, but after I was there for 3 years, she was sent in to try and discredit me.
I see. Okay.
See, but here, I met her back in Atlanta, Georgia, when Gunnarsson and I, there were 50 of us speaking at a 3-day conference for therapists and the public in Atlanta, and out of the 15 of us that were speaking there, only one of us was from Georgia. The rest of us from all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they invited in some of the top experts on CI mind control, on Satanism, on multiple personalities, and exposing the FBI, CI, etc. And so that's how I was invited there.
Okay, so getting back to Kathy O'Brien and whatever, so she'd spoken there and you know, right about the time that Polyclass had disappeared.
Yes.
And
8 months beforehand.
Right. And so when you have, and so she, you're saying that they were probably mind control victims, her and Mark Phillips?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, because, of course, you know, he was acknowledged that she was a mind control victim, and she was telling us that she was a CIA mind control victim of a chemo, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But see, what was so fascinating, well, let me just wrap up one more thing about Horowitz,
right.
Because that's another brought up. I didn't finish the punchline here. So Horowitz said, I was cameras rolling last June on the weekend. The last event has all the speakers are still in town. They get in front of a 2-hour panel discussion, and we in the audience were asked, invited to ask them questions. And so it's give and take, it's the most powerful event of the whole 2 days. And so during Horowitz with his lover up there, at least giving her name out, to the main difference, you can go on the internet and find it, but they were both up there speaking, even though they hadn't been speakers at the panel. I mean, at the event. I'm sorry, they didn't have exhibits at the okay. booth of the event like Norman had, but they were. He was a speaker.
Okay.
And so the point is, he even said this, that Ted Gunderson says that Doug Millar is the national authority on Latino. I thought, isn't that absurd that he would say that, giving Gunderson and me credibility for exposing the CIA mind control and Satanism, and then turn around and call him, but he's still calling us Satanists because we're doing it. I mean, it was just absurd. And so, anyway, you'll see some hot videos on if you go to YouTube on these two exchanges, because Anthony Hilder and Gunderson were supposed to be there to debate Horowitz and his lover. But as it turned out, since Ted was dying with cancer and died on July the 30th, uh-huh. or maybe after the 31st, I guess it was, he obviously couldn't get out of his deathbed and go there and debate. Yeah. And I wish I had a chance to fill in for Ted because, you know, I knew more about Aquino than Hilda did, you know, and uh-huh. for obvious reasons, because Aquino was born and raised right here in San Francisco, North Bay Area,
uh-huh.
in Marin County, to be exact, in San Rafael. And so, anyway, back to Kathy Bryan and Mark Phillips. What the CIA normally does is they will take someone like Kathy Bryan or Mark Phillips. He was assigned to her as her handler. Well, he was also a CIA and is a CIA mind control victim. And that's the way they have the control of both people, because they're both victims of CIA mind control. One is the handler and the other one's the performer, so to speak. And, uh-huh. you know, the gorgeous presidential models, of course, were trained to be sex slaves as even as children. Their fathers were pedophiles. And so, are you familiar with Bryce Taylor, whose real name is Sue Ford?
I'm not as up on that story, but it's one I have to get into. Go mm-hmm. ahead.
Well, the reason I say this is that she's much more credible than Kathy O'Brien, and you see that Kathy O'Brien doesn't have any people endorsing her books, her two books that she's put out as with co-author, and it's for, of course, her life story, the first one, you know, uh-huh. her autobiography, with the help of Mark Phillips. But then Sue Ford, when she put out her first book called Starshine, One Woman's Valiant Escape from CIA Mind Control, that was fiction based on fact. She used a pseudonym. Her real name, like I say, is Sue Ford. And she was raised right there in L.A., in a county. And her husband was, they met as teenagers, and he was also from a satanic generational family himself. But she was raised in a Baptist church right there in L.A. County. And so here he was, a accomplished orthodontist, and she worked in his office, and yet she started getting these flashbacks in her 30s and started to go to the therapist to try and figure out what was wrong with her, that she was having these flashbacks of blood and guts and children and murders and sex abuse and all this sick stuff. President's pictures coming in her mind, and just she thought she was going nuts. It's like most of these beautiful women when they start getting flashbacks. So there's two examples of people who had, you know, their handler was also a victim.
Uh-huh. Okay, so, but it seemed like, now, the way you're sounding like Bryce Taylor, she would seem like she started later then? They didn't get her when she was really young? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, sure, no, I'm saying that her father was a pedophile.
Oh, okay.
And even though he wasn't, and he became wealthy just like Kathy O'Brien's father, you know, they let the fathers, of course, first of all, when they give us tests in school, they ask us so many questions as young children in grade school, they identify victims of incest and the sex abuse of young children, we don't know, you know, we are, because we have all our personalities if we're a victim of this stuff, but the government finds out who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they, quite often, and I think as I recall, Kathy Bryan even mentioned that in her book, they made her father an offer he couldn't refuse, and Sue Ford said the same thing in her book.
This is just coming to mind. Wouldn't some of these social services places that have a history of incest and things like that be a place that they could go and track that sort of thing?
Yes, and you know, there are a lot of good people that work in those places, but
no, I know what you mean. Yeah, but I'm just saying, yeah, that would be a possibility, just kind of like, you know, if you wanted to get into remote viewing or psychics or whatever, you might go to a place where they train psychics, you know,
sure.
Yes, I mean, you're going to go to where the obvious place is where they're going to run across the information.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't like that.
So just because of where I was living, mm-hmm, and because we were exposing Aquino from the very get-go, because as it turned out, see, Ted Gunderson, I read about his name in the Phantom cover-up, and so right after we had DeCamp here in September, I called at DeCamp's office and asked if I'd get Gunderson's, I'm sorry, wait, let me back up here. Around the 1st of August, about 6 weeks before we had DeCamp here, I read about Gunderson's name in the book, and so I called Camp's office and asked for Gunderson's phone number.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I mean, I always said to be an FBI agent myself in high school and college, so I was really interested, although I never finished college, I never became one. You had to be a CPA or attorney back in those days, in the 40s and early 50s. So as it turned out, I called Gunderson, and it's just to give you an example of what kind of a guy he is. I had been traveling the whole West Coast for a business, and therefore I knew all the area codes. So I called DeCamp's office and got DeCamp's phone number. I'm sorry, Gunnison's phone number, and it happened to be area code 310. But wow, I wonder where that is back east. So I thought, well, I better call him early and try and catch him around 7 or 8, wherever he is, or 6, wherever he is, and before he goes to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I called.
In the middle of the night?
Yeah, I called him. The 310 number, and where am I calling? I said, I'm sorry, I woke you up. What time is it back there? He said, back where? I said, well, wherever you are, I apologize. Let me call you back. What time is it back there? He said, it's 5 a.m. I was calling California time, and here he is in California, just like me. And I said, this is the kind of guy he was. I said, well, let me call you back later when you wake up. What's a good time to call back? He said, hey, I'm awake now. Let's talk right now. Didn't even know why I was calling. It's just the kind of guy he was.
Uh-huh.
A real privilege to work with such a class man, you know, for over 19 years I worked with him. I guess I should say almost to the day, 19 years, the first time I called him.
Well, while you're talking about him, I know kind of the trials and tribulations of what he went through, and then in John DeCamp, did you have to go through a lot of that stuff too because you were investigating in these?
Well, it depends on what kind of trials and tribulations you're talking about. I had a couple people throughout my life, if that's what you mean, but I think you're talking about more than that.
Yeah, they had some more things, the way Ted talked. He had some
I've never had anybody give me arsenic or something like that, because think about it. Ted Gunderson was the highest-ranking official in our government throughout the entire 20th century to come out and expose one branch of the government. Mm-hmm. He didn't stop there with exposing the FBI. He went after the CIA, he went after the Department of Defense, he went after the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency. He went through the executive branch, he went through everybody and after them. Mm-hmm. So naturally, he was a target that they wanted to And like you said, he knew that God had was protecting his life because he had so many attempts on his life.
Right.
It's amazing.
It's amazing what he was, you know, exposing, and that was why when you see that, you know, the more I get around some of these events and see some of these alphabet soup agencies, you just have to, you know, wonder how, you know, just wonder. So go ahead and get into the mind control aspect. I don't know where we left you'd mentioned Aquino and Kathy O'Brien and Columbine.
Well, do you want me to talk more about Columbine?
Yeah.
The knowledge there? Or
yeah.
Aquino?
Do that. Well, okay. Now we'll save Aquino for another time.
Sure, right. There's lots to talk about there, and it's true, because I actually met with him in front of his home after on March the 5th of 1993 for 40 minutes.
Uh-huh.
Because he knew we were exposing him, and we'd already had Gunnarsson there. Back, like I say, in November of 92, and so here, then 4 months later, I was banging on Aquino's door, and we'd already been exposing his torture and murders of children in Santa Rosa in the county. And so, out of curiosity, he came out. I rang the doorbell, and he was living at 2430 Leavenworth Street. I'll just make this quick point, and I'll get back on the Columbine, because we know it involves, you know, CIA mind control. But anyway, what happened was that, as it turned out, the day that the camp spoke here on 9/11/92, we also showed a one-hour video where one of Aquino's victims was being interviewed by the Army CID. CID is the Criminal Investigation Division.
Mm-hmm.
She was used by him and taking human sacrifices, not only here in Santa Rosa, but also in the county and throughout the Bay Area. And so her name, his middle name is Italian, Angelo,
mm-hmm.
for angel. Her name was Angelique, Spanish for angel. Her birthday was Halloween Eve.
Hmm.
And she was a beautiful little girl. She was half Mexican. Her father was from Mexico. She also had, her mother had beautiful, large Indian cheekbones, because she was Native American, black and white.
Mm-hmm.
But she had gray skin. Her mother had gray skin. You couldn't see any Negroid features any looks of a Negro, but it came out in the daughter. She had a beautiful, like I said, beautiful little girl, and a big smile, and such a cute little thing, and it came out with her nose and also her lips. That was the only way you could identify that she had any Negroid features.
Mm-hmm.
But I just give that background because here you had a multiracial child with that birth date, and when the mother applied for housing, this low-income housing project for over 230 apartments in a project here in Santa Rosa, just about 2 miles from the downtown city hall, they asked for birth dates. And, you know, I mean, who would think of that? Well, that's awful weird. Why would they ask for my birth date, my children's birth dates, and my children's names? But that was because it was run by Satanists.
Huh.
Isn't that bizarre?
I see.
So anyway, we showed this video, and where Angelique was describing seeing Aquino take an axe and hack 3 children in the back at one event.
Wow.
And then after that, the mother took me to the house, and it was in the suburbs of Santa Rosa. And I said, that's unbelievable. I've been to this place before. Years earlier, I'd been there about 9 or 10 years earlier, because I was selling during the early 1980s. It was really tough. The economy was so bad. Interest rates were, you know, up double digit. I'm sorry, over 20% in interest rates, and also inflation was in double digit, and the economy was just going in the pits. And so I was selling barter memberships, and I had gone to this house and talked to these three brothers who had they said their brothers were moving up from Marin County, which, of course, I didn't know anything about Marin County, about Satan's or anything else at that point, you know. And
right.
But it was about 9 or 10 years before I started investigating it. But anyway, that background, and I thought, this is the weirdest thing. I've never seen three brothers look like Mutt, Jeff, and Igor. There's nothing. These guys even look all much alike. How could they be brothers? Well, probably because they had a prostitute for a mother who was a Satanist, because this is a house where those three children were hacked in the back and murdered about the time that I was there.
So did the anything come of this event? I mean, or did they just turn their heads like so many of the other investigations that I ran across?
You mean about the three murders of the children?
Yeah.
Yeah, they were covered up. And even though we showed that, we had an audience there of about 175 people to hear the camp speech, and probably 150 of them stayed there to watch the event, including the Press Democrat reporter who we'd introduced to the camp, and we all dined with the camp the night before, and we, you know, treated the reporter because we wanted to get a story out about the camp's events the next night. The Press Democrat didn't even acknowledge that the camp was in town. Never did. Either before he spoke nor after he spoke. It was like a non-event. And so we knew that the New York Times branch here was covering up the torture and murders of children. We had it, evidence to prove it.
Okay, so now to get back to Columbine.
Right.
Okay,
so the bottom line is that the boys put together what they call some basement tapes. And so on April 20th, which was the date of the massacre occurred in 99, Eric Harris, the leader of the two, he made a basement tape in his home and said that we were going to do the event April the 19th, yesterday. But Dylan got cold feet, and so now we're going to do it today. Well, think about the history of April 19th.
Right.
Okay, I don't know if you want to get into that now, but the bottom line is it's amazing history.
Right. Now, there's a lot of major events have happened on April 19th.
Exactly.
Right.
Throughout history, including way back in 1775. Paul Revere's ride started on April the 18th and went into the 19th.
Well, they call it Patriot's Day.
Yes, they did. Mm-hmm. Now, what do they call Patriot's Day? They didn't want us to celebrate April 19th, so they turn around and now they call Bush called 9/11 Patriot Day.
Really?
Patriot's Day, yep. You look on the calendars. I've got my business calendar here. I got an 8.5 by 11 spreadsheet double wide for a week, and it's listed as Patriot's Day now.
So if you want to change history, you just put it down on a piece of paper and
exactly.
It becomes part of history. Go ahead and I mean, because you had all kinds of, I mean, if you spent 3 years there, you must have uncovered all kinds of information.
Oh, it was unbelievable. We decided that one of the things we should do is take flyers and go door to door in all neighborhoods around the school because we would pick up some good information. And so I was looking for people to volunteer to go with me. And so two of us were out passing out flyers along the south border of the school. Because the homes there, they were two-story homes, and their roofs of the houses were kind of a eye level of the school. And so here we are passing out flyers. We did it in all kinds of neighborhoods all around there. We went there, and bingo, a young man said, and he was, I'd say, around 20, he said, it's sure interesting that you guys have come by here. He said, you know, my brother is a couple years older than me. The day that Columbine took place, massacre took place, we had some SWAT members on our roofs. Whoa, we knew we had a winner there. And I said, really? And so he said, yeah, my brother got a picture of the SWAT man in our house standing in uniform, because that was one of the conditions. If he wanted to go on the roof, he had to let him take a picture of him.
Really?
So the guy's got a big smile on and everything. We took up that picture, of course. And he said, down the street here, just like less than a block away, the people there, when the SWAT sniper was on their roof, after he left, they found spent bullet shells, the casings, in the gutter. I'm sorry, in the, you know, the, I guess, no, I wouldn't call it gutter. It would be the drain, you know, along the rooftop. Well, remember, the Sheriff Stone said that none of our people in law enforcement, the couple hundred that were there, fired any shots that day. So what would they have spent rifle shells doing in the gutter, in the drain?
And how far away would they have been from the school?
Good question. I'd say just roughly, maybe 500, 600 feet.
So they weren't that far away. Yeah.
Right. And so if you go in and dig through the records, you'll find that one of the police reports says that there's some of the windows in the library were shot out. But they weren't shot from the, but the glass fell inside the library, not outside.
Mm-hmm.
So the two killers were there. We know they shot a lot of the kids there. And so, excuse me, the bottom line is that if they were in there and it shot the windows out, the glass would fall outside the building, not inside. So that proved to us that the those bullets that were shot from that rooftop were to take out the killers if necessary. Now, did they do that? Well, they say that the official FBI report was that one of the killers killed the other one. But the fact is, where the bodies fell and everything, it was very obvious that that's not what happened.
Okay.
They had been killed by the sniper. And the only reason I could figure that they would not want to disclose that fact, which to me, the sniper was a hero in my book, for trying to save children's lives, is that maybe he also shot one or more of the students by mistake when he was shooting at the killers.
Because it wasn't one of them, one of those students claiming that? I mean, because you were saying that that they none of the police personnel or whatever were shooting. Is that right?
So the sheriff claimed that not a single person in law enforcement fired a shot that day.
Okay, so, but if I recall, was it Mark Taylor? Is that his name or somebody?
Yes.
Okay, somebody got
Mark is a real hero in my book.
And now wasn't he shot somehow from?
Yes,
behind?
he was shot outside before the killers went inside. So he was actually the first student shot at Columbine, as far as we know.
Oh, okay. So he was shot by Klebold or Harris. Then is what you're
yes,
saying?
Yes, we're not
okay.
sure
right.
which one. They may know, but I can't answer that question. Who actually
okay.
shot him?
Okay.
Him first, but you know they fired some shots at him. And he was talking, he'd only been there like 2 or 3 weeks because he'd been in a Christian school and his mother had lost her job and so she couldn't afford the Christian tuition, so they transferred him to Columbine. And he was actually, as a young Christian, he was talking to three Mormon boys outside and they, because Mark was between the Mormon boys and the killers, Mark was the one that was wounded the worst. So one of them had got shot, I think it was in the arm. But the three Mormon boys were able to flee. because Mark fell to the ground, of course. And when the killers came back outside, they saw him moving around on the ground. He was still alive. And they shot at him a few more times, hit him some more times, and also threw a pipe bomb at him. Thank God those pipe bombs were not very effective. And so he laid there, actually, and that's why I invited the camp to come in and meet the Taylor family, because I learned that where they lived, I papered the entire neighborhood up and down their streets and the side streets, everything all around their house, so they wouldn't think I was just trying to smoke them out. I didn't want to go and bang on the door and ask them to talk to them. I was hoping they'd call me, and they got my flyer, and they did call me. And that's how we became very close friends.
Uh-huh. So what was your summation after this event? And I'm talking to Doug Millar, and he did investigation on the Columbine massacre and as well as many other events. So what is your summation of what took place? I mean, with all the evidence and whatever, and while we've got time, wouldn't mind getting into some more of that evidence, but just to kind of put a summation of what you felt happened about this whole investigation.
Well, remember, I'm sure when you had John DeCamp on, did he tell you that after you took Mark Taylor's case?
We mainly covered the Franklin cover-up. We didn't really...
Oh, okay. So anyway, he came in about a week before Christmas of 99, and we had a dinner with him at Oriole Asian restaurant. The next day he was to speak at the church. Well, everybody was so excited to meet the camp and ask him questions and his candid comments and everything that they stayed out in the parking lot. Some of them stayed out there half the night talking. And so the next morning at 10 o'clock, none of them showed up for the event that we were going to have the camp speak. Huh. And so anyway, as it turned out, the camp took that case suing the drug companies, but he also, I introduced him about a year and a half later, I introduced him to the only teacher that was murdered there, and that was Dave Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
And I introduced him to Sanders' widow and two of Sanders' stepdaughters who were adults. And they were not going to file a lawsuit against the school or the sheriff's department or anybody, but they were willing to file a lawsuit. The camp had already prepared it. And we went over there to their house, and it was April the 19th. And we went over to their house and met with them. And then they said, yes, we will file a lawsuit against the video game companies and the movie industry and the cartoon industry for creating so many violent movies and these violent video games. And that was a $5 billion lawsuit.
Did anything come out of that?
Nothing. No, well, because when DeCamp, because he was injured in the Vietnam War, he was replying down a cliff about 40 feet, and so there were eight of them. He was the captain in charge of this team of eight, and when they were replying down, which means they had a rope, and they were dropping down as fast as they could to try and prevent getting shot coming down, the enemies below saw them rappelling, and so they shot their ropes. And I asked the camp one time, I said, so how many of you survived that? He said, well, we all fell on the rocks, and only two of us lived.
Wow.
And so it damaged the camp's back so bad, he was one of the first 30 people in the world to have an all-metal spine. He said, my spine is held together by nuts, bolts, and screws.
Wow.
And I beg not to get the operation because there was something that if you inject it in a person's spine, it will help the bone to actually regrow. But he was in such pain that after he checked it out, he went ahead and had the operation. And so I had him on a radio talk show in Salt Lake City with a chiropractor buddy of mine who interviewed me a few times.
Truat.
Jack Stockwell.
Oh, no. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I was saying the wrong name. Sorry.
No, yeah, you'd enjoy having Jack on sometime.
Okay.
But anyway, so I was able to arrange for him to have DeCamp on again in about the year 2003. And DeCamp told, after being on the show for an hour and a half, he, during a break for commercial ads, Stockwell was heard from DeCamp and then came back on the air and said, "Doug Moore is still out there listening." I said, "He called in an hour earlier. Please call him again. We want to interview right away, Doug." And so I was still listening, so I called in. He said, "Folks, John DeCamp just told me something during the break. That Doug Millar is not muzzled like DeCamp. A judge muzzled DeCamp after he went into the evidence room and saw these videos of the what the kids were talking about, you know, the what they call the basement tapes. He saw, he said that DeCamp said this about the evidence room. He said, I investigated the Oklahoma Federal Building, Oklahoma City Federal Building, evidence. He said the security for the Columbine massacre was much stronger 6 years later than the evidence, or maybe 7 years later, than the evidence security for the federal building being blown up. Now think about that. Why would that be?
Okay, but he's also revealing two major things there, right?
Exactly.
I mean, the Oklahoma City bombing had major problems, and
yep.
and same with this Columbine one. So go ahead.
And so he has both those stories in the book, but the 2005 edition was the first time he put out one, and you can go on the internet now and read the whole book for free, because he was so upset that in 2005 he found out. When he put out this new edition with a few pages on Columbine, and he said in the book, in the introduction, he put in there a new introduction for the update, stating that someday, when he gets in a financial position, he's going to blow the whole thing wide open about what really happened at Columbine.
Why? What happened to Breitbart, I'm just... Breitbart or whatever his name is, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, see, what happened was after DeCamp had his first operation, he was sent home to recover after being, you know, in convalescence for several days, of course. And what was so bizarre was all of a sudden he ended up with a terrible fever, and eventually he was fearful of going back in for the operation the second time to even have it checked out, because he knew he was risking his life having exposed the FBI and the CIA so much in his book already.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want to go back, but the doctor, when he went back to the ER after forced to, the doctor said, "It's a good thing you walked in when you did. If you'd come in there 15 minutes later, I'd be writing your death certificate, not your medical history." So Dan Camp almost waited too long.
Uh-huh.
And so after that, a doctor who was working with DeCamp that I introduced him to, she wrote a book called Prozac, Panacea or Pandora, Dr. Ann Blake Tracy, a Mormon out of Salt Lake City metro area. I've been to her home and everything. And she spoke there just a few weeks after the Columbine High School massacre.
Mm-hmm.
And came in there and was a legislative committee actually of not a formal committee. It was an ad hoc committee of several legislators in both houses, House and Senate, meeting to discuss what they suspected involved mind control. And they brought in these experts from out in that nation, and I met her. And so eventually, a year later, I was able to introduce the camp and her. We had them both in town at the same date. They both spoke at a luncheon we had. And so then they started working together, which Dr. Tracy told me that after that back operation, the camp changed. And so he, you know, for knowing that if he didn't live, he couldn't help anybody, he dropped both cases.
Wow.
Both lawsuits, yeah. He said, Doug, it was unbelievable to walk into that courtroom and see a dozen attorneys from the biggest companies in America facing me, one attorney out of Lincoln, Nebraska, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, but they muzzled him, and so he couldn't talk about anything he saw, anything he read, but he couldn't even talk about the fact he deposed Eric Harris's parents, both of them, separately. And he had their depositions. And so the judge sent out U.S. Marshals. Sorry, call it U.S. Marshals. But anyways, sent people in law enforcement to the camp's office. They demanded to have all copies of the deposition, all copies of everything, all his notes of what he had there on a deposition, but also his notes about what he saw in the evidence room. And they want to know if they had need to go to his home and to get other copies. He said, well, I don't have any. Why would I have copies in my home of the evidence I saw and everything? Of course, he was smart enough to do that, but anyway, they didn't search his home. But I'm sure that they wouldn't have found it there either. I mean, he was a very shrewd man.
And well, he'd been through it before. I mean, he's been dealing with these guys for quite a while. I mean,
exactly.
You know.
For sure. In fact, Gunnarsson said that the camp is the sharpest attorney I've ever seen in court. One time he went into court and he tried to file a lawsuit against and add Aquino and some other people to his lawsuit that he'd already filed for Paul Benassi, the key witness in the book that Frank had covered up.
Uh-huh.
And he couldn't get the judge refused to let him sue Aquino, even though Paul Benassi is a victim of Aquino.
Uh-huh.
And so, as it turned out, the camp went to court one time, and he keeps opening his file, looking at things, and then asking questions of the defense attorney and all this and that. And eventually, the defense attorney was so upset with the camp, asking all these tough questions, he said, Your Honor, I demand that that entire file that Johnny Camp has there be put in the evidence as evidence as part of this lawsuit. And so the camp, who couldn't get the things on the record, was able to get them on the record, and they, or because the judge ordered him to turn the file over. So the camp and Gunnarsson made an awesome team, because like Gunnarsson told me back in 96 there in Las Vegas, he said, you know, Doug, DeCamp and I both grew up there in Brass. Of course, you know, Gunnarsson was a lot older, probably, I don't know, 12, 14 years older. But they both played football there in high school and college, and they both, he said, we're as close as brothers. And they made an awesome team. And so, you know, after they both interviewed Kathy Brown and Mark Phillips there, during Christmas and New Year's night, too. That's why they were referred to us. And believe it or not, a week after we met to discuss bringing Mark Phillips and Kathy Bryan into Santa Rosa, because we'd never heard of Project Monarch before. We only knew about MK Ultra. So MK, I believe to be German for mind control, MK, and then
right.
Ultra, the Ultra Mind Control. And so we had him in town. It was only because a buddy of mine in Alaska decided to help us raise money and help us fund their trip to speak in Santa Rosa and also, as I said, in Polly Glass's hometown. We didn't know who Polly Glass was. We didn't know the family. We figured they were going to come after one of our children or our grandchildren, and we figured we were going to ruin the risk of that because we didn't stop these people from doing this. Their goal was, of course, to create Manchurian candidates and control our country and the world anyway, so we're willing to risk our own loved ones in order to try and stop this thing.
So did
but
you...
here, we didn't know who Polly was. We couldn't even, never even heard of the family before.
Uh-huh.
Do you have a question?
No, so it sounds like there's just tons of these mind control victims out there.
It is believed that there are hundreds of thousands of them in America.
Wow. I mean, there's so many things that we see around us that you know, affect us mentally, and there's a lot of things that can be done without having to be put under the same type of intensity programs, and you watch it. I mean, you watch it daily on how we've been programmed, but to see it into the extent that these people go to, and it's, you know, pretty frightening to see, you know, what it can and can't do, you know, what they can do. And so many of these events are your lone gunman or, you know, they try to pass.
They always want to make it sound like that's a lone gunman.
Right, right.
But, you know, the fact is that when Bryce Taylor put out her first book, Starshine, it was in, I recall she released her book in March, end of March of 1995, as I say, fiction based on fact. And in it, she talked about the fact that they had programmed thousands and thousands of victims to create anarchy, and the date was what? It was the shortest day of the year of 1999. Of course, that'd be the late December of 1999. And, of course, when I was with the camp in Washington, D.C., it would have been, let me think a lot, Labor Day weekend of 92. I was back there, and that's where I met the camp because he invited us to come back there, and he'd arranged for, if we got a round-trip ticket, that we'd have our hotel room and meals covered because he was coming out to speak, you know, just like 10 days later. And the only organization that was supporting the camp to expose this was, of all places, all organizations, Lyndon LaRouche's organization, the Schiller Institute. And so they hold an annual event there, Labor Day weekend, people all over the world. And so Lyndon LaRouche, who, of course, exposed Kissinger as a communist spy in America and went to jail because of it, plus some of his attorneys went to jail, too. They were the ones that stuck with the camp that were exposed to Franklin cover-up and the Satanism in America, involved in the FBI covering up the satanic crimes by CIA agents, officers, and all the mind control victims. And so the plan was to cause total anarchy. We saw the written plan Labor Day weekend, like I say, of 92, and this is a psychiatrist from Florida was there speaking. He said, folks, I don't expect any of you to believe what I'm going to show you and discuss with you today, because if I hadn't actually deprogrammed this man's three boys, this Montessori, who'd gone to this Montessori school, preschool, I would not even believe what I'm going to tell you. So we didn't learn this in college. And so the camp was the master ceremonies for that event. And so I went up to introduce myself after that because I finally had a chance to meet the camp. And I'd say a week later he was going to be speaking in Santa Rosa. So the bottom line is that we saw the plan. It was exposed in Bryce Taylor's book, Starshine, as fiction written as fact. And so because it was exposed by therapists all across the country, because these therapists were sharing the research and exposing it, Dr. Joseph Mengele's victims of mind control being Manchurian candidates, and of course Aquino was creating these Manchurian candidates too, because it was exposed for a plan in 99, they postponed it. But I called the camp a few years later. I said, John, would you agree that, sure, they postponed it because Bryce Taylor's book exposed it and everything. Like, they might even step up the date because it was being exposed. They might even pull it off before 99. Do you think that is there any reason for us to suspect that maybe any day they want to call these mind control victims and read the code their assignment? Because it was 75 words,
mm-hmm.
and in five columns, all with numbers, alpha 1 through 15, beta 1 through 15, delta 1 through 15, omega, theta. Bottom line is, you can imagine with keywords how much anarchy you'd cause. For example, kill your family. Take a knife and kill your family. Use a gun. Kill your neighbors. Poison the city water system. Blow up bridges. Blow up buildings. Blow up banks.
Wow.
It was all there in 75 words. And the therapist, there were about 100 of us in the room, someone passed out one sheet of paper, and I'm only going to have one copy of it. I want that copy back after you all look at it, because you could take this home with you. Show it to a mind control victim, not knowing you're going to do it. Trigger somebody, and there could be violence, and you wouldn't want to be there in the room when that if you trigger somebody. And so the bottom line is that, sure enough, they postponed it, and the camp agreed with me, and Gunnarsson did too. We know that they can trigger these people any day they want to, and there's hundreds of thousands of these victims in America.
Well, Doug, I can see that.
And they all went to daycares and were programmed the same way.
Wow.
You were at the end of the hour, so I guess it's time to let you go.
Right, I really want to thank you for coming on the program, and I can see where we've got another interview or two for sure in here covers the information that you have. I'd been wanting to interview for a while, and had caught you a time or two on Truott's program, and
Utah.
Yeah, and so I hope we can do this again, because
I'll be happy to.
Okay, well, thanks again, Doug, and
okay, Melody, thank you for calling.
Okay, and have a good evening. Goodbye.
Good night, folks.